On October 12, 2019, UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law hosted a book release celebration for Associate Dean Leah Plunkett's Sharon Hood, Why We Should Think Before We Talk About Our Kids Online. As part of the event, Professor Plunkett sat down with Dean Megan Carpenter to discuss the book and have a Q&A with the audience. This is the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about the law school and apply by visiting law.unh.edu. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire.
First of all, one of the things I'd like to focus on is this idea of a conversation starter. So you characterize the book as, you know, not kind of how to fix all the things, but as a way of starting a conversation. So as you know, now that the book is published and out, what kinds of conversations do you think you've started?
I love that question. Well, a conversation here, I've learned a lot of things tonight. Thank you, everybody who shared your expertise and everyone who's here, and hopefully we'll share questions and reflections over the course of the evening. I've been really interested in seeing the reaction to the book, which seems to be at a spectrum between terrifying and entertaining and maybe sort of at different points. And the questions that I've been getting from people have focused on a couple of key areas. One is, so what do we do? I have some thoughts. Is all hope lost? No. One question that I have gotten a lot, which surprised me, and this has come from friends, from, you know, people I've met at book talks, it came from a Wall Street Journal reporter last week, is the question goes something like this. I feel like I, or my spouse and I, or my partner and I, have a pretty good handle on sharenting in our home, but the in-laws, grandparents, aunt, uncle, whoever doesn't actually have a set of norms or practices that are consistent with ours, I don't know how to have that conversation. I'm getting that question a lot, and I wasn't expecting it. So short of saying, have them read the book, because there's that kind of time-honored tradition of like, oh, this, you know, wacky professor I know wrote this book here, you know, drop it up. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what she's talking about. But it did prompt me to think a little bit about how we talk about sharenting in a way that is open and authentic, to use Professor Roberts' term, but also doesn't shut people down. Because I wrote the book out of like Eagle Arms and Yoga, which I guess is another Leahism. Mm-hmm. I do this quite a bit. But, I joined the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society down at Harvard as a member of their youth and media team at the same time that I was parenting first one, now two young kids. And my work starting in 2013 at Berkman Klein was focused at that point on student privacy, but sort of expanded to youth privacy, and simultaneously trying to figure out, well, like, I think my kids are hilarious and cute, except when they're crazy and annoying. But like, how do I balance the desire to, you know, connect with people I know and people I don't know in terms of sharing that information? How do I balance figuring out, well, I'm busy and only getting busier, so I want Amazon to know everything about me because then they bring me things that I need, but like, oh my gosh, Amazon knows everything about me. And then there's this frustration with Amazon of like, why don't they just anticipate my needs? Why do I have to like actually order or set something for delivery, but be much more convenient? So it really was this kind of combination of like, what are the legal research questions? And also, I don't think I understand this personally. And so I needed to be a conversation starter because I need to have the conversation. And so, you know, since the book has been out, I have talked down in Cambridge at MIT Press bookstore. I've gone directly in to talk with librarians. I've talked to New Hampshire Public Radio. I talked to a really nice radio reporter from Australia. I've talked to folks in Wisconsin, Seattle, BBC, which was great because the accents were amazing. But it was very hard as a former improv comedian to listen to the accents and not try to do them myself. I'm really bad at accents, so I didn't do them, but it was like all I could do to be like, don't do it. And I think, it, you know, I just feel very excited to be able to learn from other people. And John Palfrey, who wrote the foreword to this, which was a real privilege for me. He had helped found the Berkman Klein Center, left the Harvard Law School faculty to be the head of school at Phillips Exeter, and actually just left there to head up MacArthur Foundation. But one of the things that I feel very privileged and honored by in his foreword is he says, this is all changing so fast, it is impossible to pin down how to fix all the things. And it's true. Like, I actually keep a running list of all the things that happen that have happened since I've written the book that I wish had happened before, like a smart diaper. It is a real thing. It was not a real thing when I wrote the book, but you can now have a diaper that measures urine output and it's attached to an app. And so these things are going to continue to change so rapidly that I know, right, it doesn't do bowel movements yet, so maybe the health people can explain the limits of why it's just doing urine. But it needs to be a conversation starter so that all of us can figure it out. So that those are just some of the conversations I've been having about grandparents and poop.
You know, well, you mentioned privacy as part of it, and then also John Palfrey's sort of comment that things are changing so quickly. And it seems to me one of the things that struck me in reading the book is that, you know, our definition of privacy, right, and our understanding of that really has changed over time. And how critical do you think that is to figuring out where the cultural norms are in this space?
I think it really is important for us to try to pin down what we mean by privacy. And there are so many different options to choose from. The one that...
And generational, too. Right? I mean, certainly, right? I know that, you know, a conception of privacy perhaps for someone, right, 20 years younger than I am seems to be very different than the way.
Right. And I think even within our own lifetimes, and mm-hmm, sort of, I guess I will share a personal anecdote, but not about my kids. So it's just sharing. It's not sharenting. Mm-hmm. I define sharenting as all the ways that parents, teachers, and other trusted adults do things with children's private data online. So this is just my private example. So I started college in fall of 1997. And a few weeks after starting, I got called into the assistant dean for students or dean of student life office. And I was very confused because I am fundamentally a rule follower. It's like, what did I do? And I got called in because somebody had, a senior boy had made a computer program in his computer science class. Who remembers Telnet? Pine? Yeah. So there was a command you could type into the Pine email program that there was on campus, and the command was finger, and then you'd put the person's username in, and it would tell you where they were on campus. And so a senior boy who was in a class with me and his roommate, who was in my improv troupe, I'm not going to say anyone's name, hi camera, had started through their computer science class a program that was set up to repeatedly type in the finger command to figure out where whoever they were fingering was on campus. And they were used my name and one of my good friends' names. And the program didn't turn off when they shut off their computer. So it took up so much server space that the IT folks at Harvard College got concerned, alerted the dean of students' office, who thought we were being stalked. My brother's in the audience. Did I ever tell you this story? Yeah. So how Sarah and I became good friends. So we get called in. We assure the dean of students we're not being stalked. We know these guys. They're fine. We have a conversation with them where they were like, yeah, sorry about that. It was a class assignment. You know, we thought it would be funny to see where you were. And so this was fall of 97. 2004, Facebook is founded at Harvard, right? And so even within my lifetime, it went from dean of students being, I think, legitimately worried that my friend and I were being stalked because there were other people on campus who wanted to know where we were and were using a computer system to do it, to founding yes, Facebook is huge in and of itself, but revolutionizing this idea that it is not only okay, but actually something we should volunteer, like we should check in, we should tell the world, like, I'm at UNH Law, I'm, you know, here in Cambridge. And so I do think that is happening at lightning speed. And what I sort of argue for in the book is that, yes, you can think about privacy as being protectionist or utilitarian or whatever you think about it as, but we need to think about privacy as a protected space where we can vest the creation of our identities. It's a definition I take really from Jonathan Zittrain's work, that whatever sort of outer boundaries you want to put on it, if we proceed from a notion that we need some zone of non-interference where we can cause mischief, make mistakes, and experiment to figure out who we are, that's what privacy means to me. But I do worry that in this really warp speed transformation where it goes from it's terrible for someone to use a computer to know where you are online to like we should all use all computers and phones and tablets and watches and drones and who knows smart diapers to know where everyone else is, that we're losing this idea of privacy as a protected space to play.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think about social media often as my it reminds me of my paternal grandmother, who had this remarkable way of, you know, making sure all of the family was in touch with, you know, everyone at all times. And so she would just, you know, update people, and, you know, people lived in different places. And I have often been the beneficiary of that kind of thing, because I've not lived with the, you know, close to the rest of my extended family. So social media has been such an incredible opportunity to sort of connect, and I have really treated it that way, especially with regard to my children, because it's a way for my children, if I'm sharing information about them, and I posted a picture of my son playing soccer this morning, I have no hopes or dreams that he would be, I was just happy he wasn't picking flowers on the field. But
scholarship.
I don't think so. I'm not gonna say that either. So in that context, it's been so important for, you know, the grandparents to feel connected. And, you know, how do we as parents navigate that kind of space where we realize that as increasingly with our lives lived, you know, in large part online, and it's such a, you know, incredible opportunity this weekend to have our students in the hybrid JD program here with us, who we keep having these conversations, have developed remarkable human connections with one another, even though they have spent, you know, less than a week total in person. With that need to connect with other human beings increasingly online, how do we not go crazy? Like, how do we navigate that territory?
I propose a thought compass in the book. So I'm not trying to fix all of the things. I'm truly not, because I haven't figured it out. But I do think that there are values that we can use to orient ourselves to chart a better way forward. And the values that I think about are the values around play, which I talked a little bit about, that I do think for all of us at any life stage, but particularly for children and adolescents, if you don't have a space to play, then you're really missing out on the ability to develop agency and autonomy and become who you're going to be. The other values I think about, if you're thinking about sort of a compass with cardinal direction, so play, the value that should be placed on forgetting, which Professor Hodder talked about, that we can't move forward sometimes if the past is not forgotten, a premium placed on connecting, which actually sometimes can point toward a desire to share it, and then a premium placed on respect, which Professors Roberts and Price talked about in terms of thinking about, and Professor McCann did too, in terms of monetizing children's sort of output as either an influencer or an athlete. And so within the thought compass, I don't advocate a position of, to use kind of bad 1980s public health slogans, this is not a just say no to sharenting book. It is a practice safer sharenting book. And so I really encourage people to be thinking, all right, so of these four values, which ideally can coexist, sometimes they may compete, what value am I advancing by this choice? And if the answer is that I really do think that the value of connecting, whether it's with my children or connecting my children to their extended family, is so well served by sharing the soccer picture or whatever else it is, then by all means. But for it, would any of those values, for instance, be advanced by going with a smart diaper? Maybe, or maybe your thought compass has different values. I talked about this book in my hometown on Monday, and I had two urologists in the audience. One's a pediatric urologist at University of Michigan Hospital. So apparently, I was informed, I think correctly, there can be real health benefits sometimes to tracking urine output. So, but unless that applies, you know, where on your compass of values is a particular sharenting decision going? And I think that is how we might all go not completely crazy, mm-hmm. is if there's a little bit of a practice safer sharenting, think before you click, is this advancing a value or a commitment that is important to me and my family? If it is, go for it. If it's not, or you're not sure, maybe just hit pause and try to resist the at times irresistible allure of every swoosh, click, ding, upload. And because those technologies are designed to captivate us.
Mm-hmm. You know, it struck me too that there are so many players that you talk about in this space. So, I mean, the book is about sharenting, but it also implicates, you know, educational institutions and the legal system. And one of the things I saw on Twitter just today, randomly, was
a smart diaper.
It was this kind of online digital tools consent form that was given in a county, not in the state, but the parents were asked to kind of consent. But it's just this sort of laundry list of, you know, 50 some odd apps that the students will be using in elementary school with wildly different kind of terms and conditions. And so, you know, the lawyer brain starts to, you know, try to wrestle with that. And one thing that I thought was really helpful in the book, I think in the last chapter, you talk about different models we might use. So thinking about attractive nuisance or public welfare laws or social welfare laws, public safety and social welfare. Could you explain a little bit about how those kinds of legal frameworks might serve as a model for how we might address these from a policy standpoint?
Sure. The school example is such an interesting one. When I talked about the book at MIT Press's bookstore, which is the publisher, I was joined by a wonderful gentleman who is the chief technology officer for the Cambridge Public School District. And so he was talking about sort of what a difference a good technologist can make. And I had to agree that there are certainly some individual schools or school districts where if you have a wonderful technology or information officer or privacy officer who actually is going to read all of the terms and conditions and not put the onus back on parents, the kids might be safer privacy-wise in the school. But anyway, so a little plug for some of the school districts. So the attractive nuisance framework, actually, I don't know if you remember this, Professor McCann, that was your idea that made its way into the book. It's so wonderful. I think you're even in my footnote. So it's so wonderful to be had conversations that have made its way into the book. So the attractive nuisance framework being that if a property owner, in this case a digital property, has something that they know is going to be irresistible to a child often, but it can be a grown-up as well, that they have a heightened duty to protect it or face liability. And I'm painting with a very broad brush. I have, right next to Professor McCann, I have our property expert, Professor Hearn, who could give you a much better explanation. But painting with a broad brush, it's this idea that if you know that someone is going to come want to play in your abandoned well or empty pool, put a fence around it. And I talk about in the book that we are not doing a good job now of building fences around digital common spaces. Mm-hmm. And that one of the things we should be working on, both from a potentially sort of a do not go there, build a fence to keep out, but also so let's try to shift people from wanting to play in the empty pool, which in my analogy would be just throwing kids' private information out there, not caring where it goes, to can we create protected spaces of kind of a digital playground or a digital space so that if you're putting your kids' information in it, you can be confident that it will be protected. And something I talk about in the book that kind of builds off of this idea is to move from, you know, we have sort of YouTube Kids, which actually recently got in a lot of regulatory trouble, but we have versions of social media platforms or other digital products that are supposed to be kid-friendly. What about saying, let's have versions of these products that are parent-friendly. So you and I could choose the parent-protected version of Facebook, right? Mm-hmm. If Facebook wanted to come out with that, where they would bake into the way it's designed. They would protect us from ourselves. They would fence off the attractive nuisance kind of cesspool of just throwing the digital data in and instead say, okay, you know, the soccer picture is super cute. The Elsa dress picture is super cute. And they are super cute, right? And I will just say, I mean, many of you are my, like, I have social media accounts. I share it. I mean, you know, I definitely don't just say no. But what if Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or the fertility tracking app or the sports stats app had a parent protected version so that the data auto deletes after a certain period of time, and not just from the news feed, but actually an enforceable promise that it deletes from whatever repository of data there is? What about something that is visible in terms and conditions that promises never to reshare it with a data broker or a third party that is going to use it for anything other than providing basic support for the service? So I think there are ways that we can look to attractive nuisance mm-hmm. or public welfare and safety laws to protect us from ourselves. And by us, I mean the grownups.
Mm-hmm. On Friday, the New York Times released an investigation into how photos of children that are posted on social media by Sharons are feeding facial recognition databases. And the article asks, who could have possibly predicted that a snapshot of a toddler in 2005 would contribute a decade and a half later to the development of bleeding-edge surveillance technology? So the question's rhetorical, but the answer really is that Sharon Hood could have predicted that. Near-future hypotheticals and realistic but fictional thought experiments are really central to the approach that you take in the book. Could you tell us some more about some of those scenarios, and then also why you chose to use those devices to address the topic?
Maybe I'll start with the last part of the question and then give an example of a scenario. So, the New York Times didn't cite me. I was really bummed. I read that question. I was like, come on, guys, my book's right here. Part of it, and this is another Leahism, so forgive me, the one Donald Rumsfeld quote that I will say, you know, it's like someone needs like a bingo or a drinking game for every time I say it. For hybrid students who are working with me tomorrow for 2 hours, rest assured at some point I will say it in our two-hour class together, is that there are known unknowns. And we know right now that sharenting is almost entirely unregulated by the law, certainly by parents, unless what you're posting violates a law of general applicability like criminal law. So you can't, heaven forbid, abuse or neglect your child and have it be protected by sharenting. But really, other than that, you know, social security numbers, you know, pictures and diapers, whatever it is, have at it. And other adults, so teachers and grandparents and aunts and uncles, there may be some pockets of greater regulation like in schools, but it's pretty wide open. So part of why I use hypotheticals and near future scenarios, and Professor Hodder, without actually knowing that this question was going to come up, queued me up for this, so thank you, is that we are, this book, as part of the conversation, it is designed to say to people, we are creating this kind of Wild West open season on data that adults share about the kids in their lives. And we should expect, and we know in pockets, and the New York Times expose on Friday was just the latest in the long line of revelations. If you haven't read that one, that was an expose into how social media pictures going back to 2005 have been used to build facial surveillance databases that are just now being found out about. And a lot of them were kids' photos. But we should expect, because we know that it's open season, and we know that private information is the currency in the digital world, that there are an unknown number of creepy things happening by tech providers, data brokers, government officials, and so on. And so one thought experiment I have, and the one that Professor Hodder referred to, I'll read briefly, is a near-future hypothetical scenario. You're helping your 17-year-old daughter finish her college applications. The applications require her SAT score, SAT 2 scores, AP scores, and Tykebyte's personal capital scores. What the heck is Tykebyte's? Siri tells you that Tykebyte serves as, quote, your child's passport from her past to her future. You ask Siri to stop reading the Tykebyte sound bites and do some digging. The response, TikeBytes is a commercial database that serves as a repository of childhood data and a clearinghouse into adulthood. TikeBytes aggregates as much data about each child in the country as possible and then packages the data for purchase by different types of institutions and individuals. The most popular product is a set of scores that rates children's likelihood of future success in a range of areas, including education, athletics, and employment. TikeBytes will share these personal capital scores with any individual or institution that pays for them, isn't legally prohibited from having them, and demonstrates what is, in TikeBytes' opinion, a legitimate need for them. You and your daughter don't need to do anything to have these scores sent. All colleges that receive applications from her will get these scores at no cost to individual applicants. TikeBytes does allow parents and youth age 18 or over to opt out of having TikeBytes collect and share information, but the TikeBytes website warns you that opting out risks your child's future. After all, the perky chatbot in the click here for help section tells you, an applicant without TikeBytes scores is like a car without airbags. You could take it for a spin, but why risk it? And so we're basically there, right? I mean, I don't think that particular product exists. At least it didn't when I wrote the book. I haven't Googled it recently. I should potentially see if I should like trademark that name or something. I don't know. We can talk later, maybe, both of you. But you know, we see it in so many ways already. Actually, the USTA, the Tennis Association, has a predictive algorithm to predict young players' likelihood of success.
Sorry, Mike.
Yeah, you were out. You were totally out, right? China is doing social capital scoring. This is not a make-believe sort of fairy tale scenario. And so this type of scenario, though, is where I would favor, if at all possible, and it's probably a dream, a sort of federal legal and regulatory response. Mm-hmm. But I will stop there.
I want to leave a little bit of time for questions. So what questions do you all have?
Yes.
Do you think this is all going to change or will not change until the freemium business model of big tech gets either through the market or through policy changes? Because that's a source of people are just used to not paying. And, you know, the internet wasn't like that in the beginning. It started in 2000. Gmail was actually the first that shifted because people don't remember this. You used to pay for email service.
Yeah. I think I paid for Hotmail.
Yeah.
Is that right? Did I probably pay for Hotmail?
Yeah.
And a second sub to that is it time for a digital bill of rights like we did with the patient bill of rights? Which took 2 decades, but.
Yes, and yes, I think. to both of those, I think that we don't see that we are paying for free or low-cost services with data. And one of the things I do talk about in the book is given that we can pay for it with any type of data, maybe we should pay for it with data that is less private and doesn't belong to our kids whenever possible, right? There are times when we can't, but if at all possible, maybe we should. But I do absolutely think that as long as that is the currency of so many of the technologies, both products and services that we take for granted, we are in a really tough place. A Bill of Rights would go a long way, but I don't have a lot of faith in the ability to get market-based solutions. I feel like we've been moving further away from that since the early days of the internet, but I welcome reflections or disagreement or additions. Yeah, Ken?
Well, on that, I agree with you. I think to expect a market-based solution is to ignore that the core business model of some of these companies is this. And if you simply said you can't do that, then huge companies will go to, I mean, there's going to be huge money behind fighting against something like that. But one point that, you know, Professor Minkas mentioned the other day, yesterday, was there's so much data that really the only place it can sit is in cloud repositories. And there are five companies that control the overwhelming majority of that. So they seem like a right target, even though Microsoft hasn't been listed along with the others lately. And he was sort of smiling at that fact. Regulating, first making AWS the best of, making Amazon the best of AWS, and then taking the five and saying, we can send you operate here at least, we're going to treat you like utilities. And then drive these kinds of, I don't see if you don't, and again, to get the political will is going to be complicated given the money that we'll be fighting it, but is that a strategy that you've thought about? Or because right now, the Senate, who didn't know how Facebook worked, for example, right?
Yeah.
Are theoretically looking for ways to regulate. Is this something that,
Rami, go first. I know you probably heard Professor Minhas. Yes. So Professor Mickey Minhas is the also is a wonderful member of our faculty and also the chief patent counsel for Microsoft. So he was here teaching yesterday. So I didn't hear his remarks, but I appreciate your sort of summarizing them. I am very intrigued by the potential crossover between the antitrust sort of wave that is sweeping around big tech and privacy. I will confess that I have not done the scholarly research to see sort of from a very nuts and bolts law nerd way, what this sort of interplay might be. I would think it would stand to reason, painting with a very broad brush, that if you move away from a model of control by sort of a big five of being these sort of warehouses of private data, that you would have a better ability in terms of passing new statutory laws or new regulations or even new enforcement actions to really kind of connect what those companies were doing with what the increasingly, I think, popular will is toward privacy. But I have not figured out yet, and if anyone in this room has ideas, we have a lot of very smart people in this room, I have not figured out exactly what the hook would be, but I would expect that there could be one.
But it occurred to me when you were saying making them
right.
accountable for the attractive nuisance fence.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The fences are going to be there.
Yeah. Right. Professor Price?
Are you fundamentally optimistic or pessimistic about this? Are we going to be better or worse with respect to this?
I was hoping you were going to answer the antitrust question. otherwise, I wouldn't have called in you. I'm just kidding. I am fundamentally optimistic, but that's just because I'm an optimistic person. I think that actually if you look at the sort of objective trajectory and take out sort of my own personal glasses half full nature, there's a lot to be more pessimistic about than optimistic, really, because we don't have a way to hit the brakes on something like tyke bites or ways in which data about our kids before they're even born gets aggregated, analyzed, acted upon in ways that we as parents have no insight into and no control over. So while I am optimistic about the increasing, I think, public will toward better data privacy, better cybersecurity, you know, potential sort of use of antitrust to break up big tech monopoly power, I think there are a lot of really optimistic sentiments, and conversations like these make me optimistic until we also have the ability to have some overlay of not just state legal action or regulatory action, but actual federal statutory reform around privacy. I think I should probably be a little bit pessimistic.
Mm-hmm. To combine sort of both of the things, I think that you know, both of the last questions, one of the things that came up in the class yesterday was talking about the aggregation of data for to sort of benefit the public welfare and safety and counteract the influence of big companies. So for example, I think there was some discussion of using AI, which you talk about in some detail in the book, perhaps deal with autonomous cars and safety. And so if there's sort of the aggregation of data from different automobile companies, then Toyota, that would have a huge market share, wouldn't want that all that data to be aggregated because they would want their own proprietary data. But the smaller car companies would like to see that because you would have the benefit of greater safety,
right,
and you could create safer products if you have the aggregation of data. So I'm wondering if in some ways The optimism can also be connected with AI, which can be part of the problem, but potentially also part of an architectural infrastructure solution.
I like that. I like the grounds for optimism. I've always looked for those. We had a couple of more hands out there before we wrap up.
I'm not a parent, but I'm an international student, and this seems like a global problem. And I was wondering if you're planning on adjusting your book into the European regulations, because I think the GDPR can influence sharing to it in a different perspective than in here in the United States. So I was wondering if you plan on doing that, and if you plan on making any comments with Sharon Tood about the California Privacy Act and the regulations that are that came out recently for that.
Wonderful, wonderful questions. So the GDPR, General Data Protection Regulation, which went into effect in the European Union in May of 2018, is far better on privacy than anything we have here. And California, as is often the case, is at the vanguard on the state level when it comes to rolling out a new privacy, a new consumer privacy law that I believe goes into effect in January of 2020. So there, the timing of when the book was written was such, and the text had to be finished was such that I did not, both by design, I was trying to stay US focused. So I have just a couple of pages on GDPR. And then with California, it sort of wasn't as far along when I actually had to finalize the text. I do think that Sharon Hood 2, my son told me he was gonna write Sharon Hood 2 and put a poop emoji on the cover. This is an actual conversation. And I said, why? Because you think sharenting is so stinky. He said, no, because maybe grown-ups share pictures of kids' poop, and then we had to stop talking. But I do actually think that for the book that comes next, a comparative perspective and also a deeper drilling down into the states would be very valuable. Two very quick reflections now. So it is a little bit unclear to me if GDPR actually, as it is written on its face, would necessarily stop parents from sharenting with kids who are below the age of consent in their member countries. It doesn't look to me like it does. And I've asked a couple of GDPR experts, and I haven't gotten a firm answer. So GDPR is great in terms of, and again, I'm going to paint with a very broad brush, a right to be forgotten or a right to erasure once you are sort of at the age of majority and you can request removal. But it actually isn't clear to me at all. And in fact, my best reading, and again, keeping in mind I'm not an international privacy scholar, is that GDPR actually would not protect a child under the age of consent for data sharing in a member country if that child wanted to stop a parent from deciding to share something about that child. So even, and similarly, in some of the state laws that we've seen develop, again, California's on the vanguard, but we have also seen in states across the country, since I believe between 2013 to 2018, we saw 42 states consider 300 bills and 25 states pass 59 new laws on student data privacy. So that's sort of the biggest area of youth data privacy focus. A lot of those laws still are putting parents in a role of consenting or not consenting unless an exception applies. Some of them do a better job and actually regulate the tech companies directly and sort of take parents out of the picture, which I think is probably better. But I think as long as either individual states or national or transnational regulations are keeping parents as the decision maker rather than regulating at the level of a tech company and saying to the tech company, even if you get the data legitimately, there is a whole list of things that you cannot do with it under any circumstances unless you have a very specific consent from either a parent, if you're dealing with a minor, although I might move it to 16 for a minor, or a child if you're dealing, you know, with 18 or over, and that the child, through a guardian or once they attain the age of majority, should be able to revoke that. So in other words, I would want to see a law that says, okay, tech companies, if you get information about a minor, bless you, under 18, I don't care what source you get it from, you cannot use it for marketing, advertising or to make decisions about that child's life opportunities, and you could sort of define what those life opportunities were at any point in the child's life, even once they're 18, if you got it about them when they were a minor, unless there was a very clear and very specific opt-in for a particular use, like the tennis algorithm, you can't have it. And then you give a private right of action to the child that they can enforce through a parent or through a guardian or a next friend that would actually start when they were a minor and continue once they were an adult in case it turns out that their college application was negatively impacted by the fact that they wet their bed till they were five. So they could actually collect damages for that. And you had a question.
I did. It was actually sort of along those lines, actually. So it's nice. When I'm looking at sort of not data as individual data points or even certain data that we don't want people to have access to, but rather what we're using as an analytic. That's something that gets very concerning for me and how that analytic can be used and what rights we might have to potentially fight that analytic. And I brought that up only because I was sharing with my friends, colleagues, whatever we are. They have patent examiner statistics, for example. I'm a supervisory patent examiner at the office. And there are judgments about me and what people might think or infer of my behavior, which could adversely affect me later on after I get out of here based on whatever someone might be judging. And it doesn't seem like I have any right to say, hey, I'm not sure that you're looking at these slices of data the right way, or it's even supporting the conclusions that you might be coming to in this nice chart that I see.
It's
the type base for the USPTO, right? And at this point, we're still in a setup where your right to access that and to query it is going to be very sector specific. It's going to depend on, you know, whether there would be some sort of regulation or policy in your specific space, or I guess a federal law or a state law, that would give you the ability to request access, not just to what the analytics say about you, but what the underlying algorithm, which may well be proprietary, right? What that algorithm is spitting out. And there are some, you know, pockets where we are seeing that. And of course, I should also say, you know, I am married to a ferocious litigator who would have me say that, of course, you know, give any of these problems to a high-octane litigator and go back to your basic principles of contract law and sort of, you know, employment contracts and policies and all of that, and, you know, try to have it out on an individual basis. And so giving that law nerd sort of caveat for, you know, there can always be creative theories if you're litigating an individual dispute with a great attorney. As you're thinking about an overarching approach, it's still really sector specific, and we don't have good protection, even as grown-ups, for determining, you know, in a blanket sort of way, what types of analytics are being used about us by the different decision makers in our lives, be those in an employment context, in an insurance context, in a credit's a little bit better, you have access to a credit report, still not great. So, yeah, there and then there. Yeah.
Okay, so this book is making me look at my children's lives who are now 21, 19, and 12, and what I have done.
Not the intention!
But I like to take a derivative of this.
Please.
And see it through my own kids' eyes what another way. Mm-hmm. For example, 8 years ago, we used to post on Picasa, and we don't use that anymore. My 19-year-old does not use Facebook, refuses to. Not because she doesn't like it, she doesn't just use it, it's old. And the question is then this way, does the data show anything about app exhaustion in that that technology may actually be going so fast that it'll actually outdate itself and the regulation may not be able to be implemented in time to catch up with the change?
Yes, that is a huge problem. It's probably even at a very mini level in writing this book, right? That between the time when the editors pried it out of my hands and when it actually came into the world, a lot changed. And so I think that there, that's why sort of I think a future regulation and certainly statutory reform would have to be done in a fairly broad brush way so that you were not tying it to technologies that were in existence at a particular point in time. And I think that is a chronic structural problem with regulating digital technology is, you know, you start talking about the internet and all of a sudden we have apps. You start talking about apps and all of a sudden we have artificial intelligence and smart devices. And so that's one of the big structural reasons that law has tended to lag behind technology as a solution space. Your question also brings up, I think, another problem or maybe even paradox that, so you talk about using outdated apps or storage platforms. So somewhere there's some tech provider that, you know, has the pictures, could access the pictures, may have been extracting data from the pictures, may have had some sort of security breach where now someone else has your pictures, but you don't have the pictures because you've forgotten the login, you've forgotten you used it, you never printed out hard copies. So it's this weird tension that the digital world may be remembering, and I don't necessarily mean humans looking at them, but data brokers or, you know, derivative companies that have picked it up, where maybe your 19-year-old daughter can't find the pictures you took of her when she was 10, because who knows where. I mean, this is a problem in my house, and my kids are younger. Like, I've the whole bunches of pictures, they're somewhere in the internet. I'm not quite sure where they are.
The irony is, you don't have apps yet. Prefers a Snap, and they don't save anything.
Right, of course, because she prefers it because
I know the server doesn't save anything, but it's supposed to not to.
Right.
I understand that, but the point is, initially they're deleting it, right?
Right.
So maybe it'll handle itself, and I think Facebook's already experimenting. I think they want to have a similar platform with only 100
stories,
and that deletes as well, right?
Right.
I don't know.
And I think, and I'll take this question, then we'll wrap us up and have some dessert. I think, you know, part of it is there will always be humans at the other end. And so I think at this point it sounds quaint and old fashioned, but things can be screenshotted and saved and reshared even with Snap. So it never really goes away. And this is also where we still don't have, especially with a company like Facebook, really good transparency into what they themselves are doing, what third parties are doing. I mean, you just kind of wait to open. Oh, sorry, AJ, I hit the microphone. I wasn't supposed to touch. I got a specific warning. You know, you just wait for the next scandal for Facebook in particular. So, last question.
So this is a technical question. You talk a lot in the book about wanting to allow our children to make mistakes and then allow them to leave them in the past and move on as adults. What I see on social media is sort of a countervailing pressure, which is be more real, show the messy stuff, think about adolescent girls in particular that are bombarded with these images of perfection that have really no relevance in real life. And so I'm wondering, what do you think not the mood of those of us in this room who are reading your book and thinking about these things, but the mood of the everyday social media user? Are people moving in a direction of being more attentive to privacy, or more inclined to share it even more so that social media becomes less curated?
Quick show of hands, who thinks people are moving towards more privacy?
Okay.
Yeah, fair enough, Professor Hearn. Who thinks people are having the other option, sort of being more curated, right? Oh, I'm sorry, sharing more, sorry.
They're sharing viewpoints, right?
Right.
That I think people are doing more and more. Maybe they're not sharing an image, but yeah, I think like Marcus was saying, kind of depends on the context of the sharing, right?
Right.
You look at TikTok.
I'm scared to look at TikTok.
I just saw my daughters yesterday and we had a talk. I mean, but I'll bet your parents are starting to do that too.
Yes.
It's getting too weird. There's way too many things that are being posted that shouldn't be. And it's causing, at least in my world, to go away from it rather than go toward it.
I think I love these answers in this debate. And Sarah, I think it really does vary at the level of different types of networks or communities, right? That there are a lot of people starting to think maybe more thoughtfully and strategically about, do I really need to preserve, you know, the toilet training struggle or the temper tantrum for posterity? And at the same time, there are people who are taking a bit of a privacy fatigue and just sort of, well, it's all going to be out there anyway. And I don't think that we have landed completely. I will say that when it comes to what kids think about adults, I think they think we have a lot to learn. A Microsoft research team, actually, to go back to Professor Minhas, just came out with a study this week that was saying of a survey they did, and I think it was international, actually, of teens' perspectives on sharenting, which they were defining somewhat more narrowly. I define it to include, you know, the smart diapers, the surveillance technology, but it's commonly defined just to include social media, that it was definitely, it was 40%+ of the teens surveyed thought that parents had a problem and that we were doing it wrong. And you have to allow for some aspect of just every generation thinks that. But I do have to say, I think that kids now may really have a point, because while there are some, I will say, younger parents who, you know, didn't go to college when the email system was Telnet, a lot of us who are parents now did not grow up with any of this. And so we're figuring it out at the same time as our kids are, or maybe even more slowly than our kids are. And so this may be, I shouldn't say the one area, but one of the areas where listening more and learning from our kids may hold more answers than we think. There are some schools now that are either voluntarily, or in the case of at least one state, Washington State, which in 2016 passed a law requiring primary and secondary public schools to teach digital citizenship, that our kids have a uniquely thoughtful perspective on this. So I think that there may be, in addition to sort of thinking about what is the general mood, there may be different generational moods as well. And so I think we should probably wrap up and go have some dessert in the IP Rotunda. And there are books available. Books available. Okay. Do you want to say anything? I usually don't have a voice. But I will say thank you all for coming out on a holiday weekend. Special thanks to Professor Roberts, who has worked so hard to make this happen. She lost her voice. And to AJ and John McLennan and everyone who spoke and everyone working security, and to all of you for sharing reflections. It's been great. Thank you, Megan, for the interview.
Professor Leah Plunkett's Sharenthood, Why We Should Think Before We Talk About Our Kids Online, is now available everywhere, published by MIT Press. Thanks for listening to the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about us by visiting law.unh.edu or following UNH Law on social media. Be sure to comment and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Spotify. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire.